What's your favorite way to experience NPR Berlin? At 104.1 FM, you can find our stories on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and SoundCloud. Discover a different way to understand our stories. Join us at nprberlin.de and click on Ways to Connect.
Welcome back to Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin and NPR Worldwide. I'm RJ McGill. I'm joined today by my co-host Ashley Bamford, who will introduce today's guests. Here's Ashley.
Writer Mary Capello's work has been characterized as stretching the boundaries of the contemporary essay, fading into sensory poetry and imaginative journey. Trained in 19th century American literature, Capello has branched out into an array of topics and styles, in topics ranging from Gunde van Hagen's Body World exhibit to the psychology of tears, from queer theory and portraiture to the experience of silence in a silent theater. Her forthcoming book is called Life Breaks In, A Mood Almanac, to be published by University of Chicago Press in 2016. Today, Capello sits down with Berlin-based poet and translator Alexander Booth to discuss the future of the essay and her current project, which is concerned with, among much else, sound.
Mary, I was thinking earlier this evening about how it's quite incredible that we only met 3 or 4 weeks ago when I went to the American Academy and you were introducing an author. And you spoke that evening, and I knew I had to speak to you immediately afterwards when you mentioned the artist Valeska Gerhardt.
Yes.
How did you come across her? How were you introduced to her work?
Well, you know, it was really wonderful to meet you, and by way of Valeska Gerhardt Alexander, I came to her by way of a film by Volker Schlindorf called Coup de Grâce, and I hadn't known of Valeska Gerhardt prior to seeing her exceed the frame of this film, and she just appeared as such a lushly queer and performative figure, and I thought, who is this? I was actually introducing Robert Beachy that evening, who was speaking at the Academy from his new book, Gay Berlin. And in my introduction, I thought I must smuggle in Valeska. Since meeting you, of course, we've had the wonderful occasion of finding so many interests in common, and including mood rooms that are set in cemeteries, both in Rome and here in Berlin. And your interest in translating Valeska Gerhardt. So it's wonderful to meet a wonderful poet as yourself and translator. I'm glad we're talking to one another today.
Well, thank you very much. And you just mentioned, again, in this conversation earlier this evening, that you and your partner had quite an interesting experience of mood recently near Wannsee in Grunewald when you were looking for quite a different grave.
Yes, once again, what you're looking for isn't always the thing that ultimately moves you, and this is very much related to our subject today, actually, of the way that essays move and the sort of aesthetic that compels me. But in this case, it was going in search of Nico's grave in the Grunewald and arriving at this extraordinary place, a walled-in, intimate, small cemetery deep in the woods that, as I understood, was unconsecrated ground, originally a place where suicides were buried. What happened was that we didn't find ourselves gravitating to Nico's grave. We were so moved by the surround, the other rough-hewn stones there, the almost arboretum-like quality of it. And it was one of the most beautiful and mood-imbued places, frankly, that I think we've encountered in Berlin since arriving.
Well, I think that's a great way of coming to your latest work, entitled Life Breaks In, A Mood Almanac. It's such an incredibly rich title. And I wanted to ask you, what is its origin? And more particularly, perhaps, what is mood?
Oh, what is mood? Well, let me backtrack and maybe try to talk first about the origin of this project. I was trained as a poet, but I write in this between state genre known as literary nonfiction that is a sort of prose poetry and has an affiliation with the essay but is not reducible to essay. And I like to write about things that are everywhere apparent but underthought, or that are indefinable, ineffable, and yet essential to our being. Mood, I came to it by way of, I was reading about 10 years ago, tutoring myself in a fairly new field known as sound studies, looking at the nature of sonic phenomena as it relates to literature. I happened upon a book by Didier Anzieux, a French psychoanalyst, called The Skin Ego. He calls this concept the sonorous envelope. And the idea of the sonorous envelope is that you and I are not lent our sense of ourselves as embodied or as having a skin. Only or even by way of touch, but more so perhaps, and more indicatively, by the way in which the voices of our earliest caretakers actually serve as a sort of holding environment. The voice is something that lends us a kind of skin, both precarious and requisite. It seemed to me that there was something there worth pursuing with regard to mood, that moods are like envelopes that are there and not there. And I thought, perhaps I could pursue this relationship between mood and sound.
You're listening to writer Mary Capello speaking with poet and translator Alexander Booth on NPR Berlin.
You'd search bay at any cost.
Whenever I told somebody I was wanting to write a book about mood, they presumed, for example, that I must be writing a book about depression. And that depressed me because, of course, mood is so much more interesting than that. It encapsulates so much more than depression. And depression, after all, when we look at it etymologically, is also indicative of kind of shrunkenness. It sort of has, to my mind, as a word and even as a concept, sealed the lid on the tomb of consciousness. If we even consult the OED, we discover such wonderful words for states of minds, everything from jaw fall to tristesse and to be in the mully grubs. You know, there are all kinds of wonderfully mellifluous words. They're even onomatopoetic for...
Which is also very appropriate, sorry to interrupt you,
sure.
But November and December in Berlin. No.
No question. But what words would be available, you know, to describe the feeling of November, December in Berlin? Sadly, if you were in the States, we might only have access to the word depression. So between this shrunkenness and my sense, a kind of sense that pervades my career as a writer, that tone is paramount to everything we do, I was moved to want to investigate tone and to create something like a much broader, wider, more variable tonal repertoire in the writing than what we typically avail ourselves of.
Do you feel that you were successful?
Success is an interesting word. I don't know if I ever think of myself as successful as a writer, and it's not a word that I apply actually to writing. I think that art making happily runs athwart the realm of progress and success. Success would suggest to me, Alexander, that I had arrived somewhere, that I had achieved something. And of course, we're quite preoccupied with that in our daily lives. But the beautiful alternative of art to me is that it never arrives. And that's why I have to write the next book. So,
well, that's what I wanted to say. I mean, wouldn't you say that in a sense is perhaps, if I could use the word, the foundation of all of your writing? That as some weeks ago you gave this talk at the ICI on erring.
Yes.
Maybe you could talk about that a little
bit
more.
Sure.
That in the sense that it's never finished.
Yes.
It never quite arrives. The diversions that are.
Thank you.
What are more
thank
interesting.
You. Yes, that I'm interested in a kind of writing that doesn't aim. And so I like to bring us back to Gertrude Stein, who tutors me in this way. There's a wonderful, very brief passage in her poem, Patriarchal Poetry, where she writes, "What is it? aimless. And I love that the double entendre of aimless as both adjective and command. And I take that instruction. I try to aim less and move aimlessly. The beauty of the essay is that it invites wandering and wend. And, you know, I often work with my students in this way. We try to think about what it means to come at a subject without beginning at the place where we are usually trained to begin. So it has to do with the importance of vantage point. I'm trying to write something, and I know that I'm supposed to begin here. And I want to say, see what would happen if you began over here. And what sort of truth would emerge if instead of directing ourselves to the center that we, in the way that we're trained to look, we look elsewhere, ever with the subject in mind, but looking elsewhere. And this is, in a way, very much a principle of most of my writing.
I want to go for a moment back to something you mentioned about, in particular, waiting. Rereading the introduction to Life Breaks In, I was struck in particular by the following. You write, "I only know that there is a kinship between the ability for a person to be open to strangeness and the ability of a person to be able to wait. Our moods are strange to us, yet abiding. I want, if nothing else, to produce a form of strange beauty in mood's name." Why do you think that that's so important, especially to today's situation,
yeah,
or landscape, if we will?
Well, I came to this thinking while sitting in a train station recently, and with my iPhone to hand, like so many people, and realizing that I hadn't for quite a long time, or at least since I had purchased my iPhone, experienced the strangeness of an unknown train station. And I was remembering how I used to inhabit train stations when I didn't have an iPhone, and how I would be required to feel uncomfortable, and how I would be required to notice, and how I would be required to be in that space that we claim not to enjoy, but it's such a fertile place to be waiting. What is an almanac? It's a miscellany built inside a chart-bound form. And we like the unpredictability of that, of a voice speaking to us, a book that works as a companion, one eye to the earth, one eye to the heavens. I'm not following mood as a language, but I'm also keen not to try to define it or pin it down. It seems to me that the problem, in fact, that mood presents me and us with aesthetically is that it refuses to be contained. And so what I've tried to do with mood is to wait for it and hope that it will show itself to me if I'm patient enough. I'm very moved by the work of John Constable, of course, the great painter of clouds, who said that, you know, when he would go out to look at the clouds, he gave us a verb for what he was doing. He said he was skying. And he didn't say that he was trying to paint clouds. He said he was trying to do something like clouds. And so in a way, if this helps, this is what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to create something, a kind of literary work that has an affinity with mood, but I'm not claiming or trying to define mood.
Mary, thank you so much for being with us this evening on Berlin Journal. It was a real pleasure.
Come on. University of Rhode Island writer and professor Mary Capello, a Holtzbrinck Fellow at the American Academy in Berlin this past fall. After this short break, we'll be back with an interview with medical historian Monica Green, who's taken on the monumental task of writing a history of global health. You're listening to Berlin Journal from NPR Berlin.
On Fresh Air, you can hear interviews that make you see the world in a new way.
Every drink of water you take,
every pot of coffee you make is dinosaur pee because it's all been through the kidneys of a Tyrannosaurus rex or an Apatosaurus many, many times because all the water we have is all the water we have ever had.
You just never know what you'll learn next on Fresh Air. Join us.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 104.1 FM.
Welcome back to Berlin Journal. I'm RJ McGill. I'll hand you over again to my colleague Ashley Bamford, who'll introduce our next guest, medical historian Monica Green.
The Ebola outbreak of 2014 in West Africa was a distressing example of the global reach and scope of deadly epidemic diseases and their containment. The spread of epidemics such as plague, avian bird flu, smallpox, and tuberculosis forces researchers to examine the human connection that has allowed diseases to flourish, not just across the globe, but also across time. Academy Fellow Monica H. Green, a historian from Arizona State University, is attempting to unite multiple disciplines in a project she calls The History of Global Health. She's concerned with how diseases emerge and multiply to reach epidemic proportions over the past centuries. Green deploys historical narratives to explain the natural history of pathogens and the human causes of their reach. Today, she sits down with Michael Gordon of Princeton to discuss her work in this pioneering new field.
So, Monica, as a historian of medieval medicine, you've embarked on a rather interesting and expansive project to do a global history of disease. So how do you get from working on a specific century in a specific part of Western Europe to tracking illness across the globe for all of the history we can record?
Thanks, Michael. That's a wonderful question, and it really is the heart of the explanation that I can give about how I came to think of the crazy idea of doing this book. I am a medievalist and work on Western Europe. And the two diseases that are most significant in medieval history are plague and leprosy. And those are two diseases about which I found it very difficult to talk as a historian for different reasons. Plague has a history of being a contentious disease. There was a question that was raised several decades ago about whether plague was really plague.
When you say plague, you mean the Black Death?
Well, the Black Death. But there's also another major pandemic that occurs at what we consider the beginning of the Middle Ages, which is called the Justinianic Plague. So it's a question for both of these bookends of the Middle Ages. And so what is the question, is plague plague? Well, since the late 19th century, we have understood plague to be caused by a microorganism, a bacterium, that's called Yersinia pestis. And it's called Yersinia because it's named after the person who discovered it. His name was Yersin. And that is a single-celled organism that has to replicate in certain kinds of ways. Mostly, it's a disease that lives in rodents, all kinds of different rodents, from rats to gerbils to marmots, and they live in a variety of different places. Plague doesn't normally live in humans. In fact, if it comes into a human body, it kills us, or our immune system will fight it off and we'll get rid of the infection. But we don't carry plague. So except for in certain circumstances, I could never give you plague, that there are no plague carriers. So what that means is that you have to have a larger circumstance of rodents all around you that carry the disease around. And one of the words that I love telling my students about is commensal. Commensal is a good Latin root word that means something or somebody we share our table with. Mensa is the word for table. And to share our table with rodents means that they live around us. They live at our feet, they live in the crannies, under the wall, and so forth. Now, plague doesn't normally live in these commensal animals, the rats, mice, and a few other things that love to live around humans. It lives in other kinds of rodents that usually don't live anywhere near humans. So these marmots, for example, that live high in the Tibetan highlands, for example. So the problem with plague is that it's hard to explain it as a disease of humans. It's hard to explain how plague would move around into different human communities. And what we've always known about the Black Death is it killed a lot of people. It killed them very quickly. And so the argument was raised, well, was this really plague?
What else might it have been if it were not plague?
Well, some suggestions that have been raised, I've never found them particularly plausible, but suggestions have been raised of maybe this was anthrax, maybe it was typhus, maybe it was this, and these are ideas that started coming out in the 1970s. Maybe it was one of these new hemorrhagic fevers we had been just learning about in Africa at the time. So there were actually some suggestions that it might be Ebola. And the problem is this, and this is one of the central things that animates what I do as a historian, is that historians were raising these questions, mostly historians and a few others. They couldn't answer the question. And the reason why they couldn't answer it is because the kinds of things we use as sources to reconstruct the history of the Middle Ages are texts, written documents.
So there's a puzzle in that the texts the medievalists can use, the sources a medievalist has, aren't sufficient to answer a rather interesting question, which is what killed a large chunk of the population of Europe. So what do you turn to if not texts or buildings or other human artifacts?
Okay, so the people who lived in the Middle Ages wouldn't have seen microorganisms because they didn't have the equipment and didn't have the conceptual categories to think of them. The 19th century and 20th century had microscopes and microorganisms and ways to explain how these single-celled organisms can cause disease. And so they started looking at plague in the modern world and saying, wait a minute, plague in the modern world is different from this massive disease that we see documented in our medieval texts. Therefore, it must be a different thing. So that's part of the rationale. But the question is, because it's created as a question about microorganisms, who are the people who work on microorganisms?
Biologists, I would assume.
Microbiologists, yes. And so really what the historians did was dig themselves into a hole out of which they couldn't get themselves, because they were never going to find texts that told them about microorganisms. The way to determine a microorganism that causes a disease is to actually find the microorganism.
You're listening to historian Monica Green speaking with Michael Gordon on NPR Berlin.
Something happened. It started in 1998. I learned about it about 2005. That's one of the ways in which being in different disciplines, people learn about different things differently. So that seven-year gap was significant. But what I found out was happening among microbiologists was that they were starting to develop ways to find and determine the character of microorganisms that had died a long time ago.
So how do you do that? I assume it involves digging up a grave.
Okay, so there's another field. It's called paleopathology. Paleo is a word that everybody knows, paleoanthropologists. Paleontology, the people who study dinosaurs. Paleopathology looks at paleo, old, pathology, diseases. And there are anthropologists who know how to look at a skeleton. And from the scars on the skeleton, the lesions that are caused on a skeleton, can determine some of the things that happened to that person while they were alive. But for plague, I was told, no, we're never going to find evidence of plague.
Is that because plague doesn't leave any marks on the skeleton that you can find later?
What the scars on the bones are really is remodeling. Your bone is always decomposing, if you will, but also regrowing. And the scars that you would see from, so if you broke your bone in a biking accident, there would be regrowth. And then you could someone who's trained to look at bones could see, oh, well, this person had had a broken bone. But something that kills you quickly isn't going to have time to do that. It's not remodeling the bone in any way. So something that kills you, as plague does, within 7 to 10 days, maybe even faster, is not going to leave any mark on the bones. But the transformation was an idea that some researchers had to look at a different part of the bony structure that survives. So we have our bones, but another thing that usually survives is the teeth. The enamel of your teeth is one of the hardest substances in the human body. So it preserves what's inside very well. Well, what's inside is not hard. It's soft and it's vasculated, which means that there's a blood supply that comes into your teeth. That's how your teeth grow, stay healthy, and allow you to be able to chew throughout your life. So what if somebody had this idea? What if we could look inside the teeth of these people that died centuries ago and see if there was anything left of something that was circulating in their blood? See if there was any organism that had been circulating in the blood that was preserved in the teeth. And this is what has transformed the work on the history of plague, is that they were successful. Their successes have been rare. The successes have been few. But for the 18th century, the 16th century, the 14th century, and most recently all the way back to the 6th century and even the Bronze Age, that was the most recent discovery that was made, we now have been able to reconstruct the genome, the genetic material of Yersinia pestis. And we're able to say with some certitude, not some certitude, as much certitude as modern science can create, that yes, this was the same disease that we thought it was all along.
So I can see how a lingering question, a problem about the history of plague, which is central to the Middle Ages, led you into exploring what the biological literature could tell you. I can even see how that would take you to leprosy. I don't see how that takes you global. So how did you move from these two specific diseases outward to other diseases that weren't manifest in the Middle Ages in Europe? And which diseases are we talking about and where are they?
One of the things that has happened with plague is that they have been able to reconstruct the whole genome. The whole genome of Yersinia pestis is about 4.6 million base pairs long. So why is that significant? That's significant because you have the genome of 14th century plague. You can compare that to the genome of 21st century plague. Plague still exists in the world, in Asia, in Africa, in South America, in North America, in all of these places. I live in Arizona. We have plague in Arizona. So you can take modern samples of the organism and compare it to the reconstructed genome of the 14th century organism and start to make historical inferences about how this matches up. Is the 14th century genome closer to one that's in Russia now or closer to one that's in Southeast China?
So studying these kinds of diseases necessarily takes you to a global distribution.
Okay, so as I said, humans aren't the ones who carry plague in their bodies. So the question is, how does plague move around? How has it moved around? And in studying that, I realized that I could also study other aspects of the globalization of diseases. So another disease that I teach about, I'm not a specialist researcher on it, but one that I teach on it because I teach history of medicine is HIV/AIDS. And the story of HIV/AIDS was one that began in 1981 with the first clinical diagnoses of patients having these clusters of symptoms, which were clearly due to their immune systems breaking down.
And those diagnoses were, I believe, in L.A., in Los Angeles.
In L.A. and San Francisco, and then very soon after in New York. That was 1981. We now believe that the history of HIV/AIDS goes back to about the 1920s. And that reconstruction was the work of geneticists. who were doing basically the same kind of work that I've just described for the plague, is taking a variety of samples that are distributed from all over the world and comparing them and working back an inference of how they are related one to another. So genetics can do this work with HIV/AIDS. It can do this work with cholera. It can do this work with malaria. It can do this work with any of the genomes of these bacteria or malaria, which is a protozoan, or viruses. So the ways in which genetic analysis of these diseases has transformed our historical understanding of the diseases, and that's the history is also connected to the geographic distribution. So the diseases I study are all of are diseases that can be studied in several ways. The genetics has created some kind of story for them. Historical sources tell us something about humans' experience of the disease. And in several cases, the paleopathology can also give us some physical record of the ways these diseases have shaped and transformed and destroyed human bodies.
Thank you very much, Monica, for joining us on Berlin Journal. It was fascinating to hear about the project.
Thank you very much.
Historian of medicine, gender, and medieval culture, Monica Green of Arizona State University. She was the Anna Maria Kellen Fellow at the American Academy last fall, working on a book about the history of global health. She spoke with Michael Gordon of Princeton University. When we come back from a brief break, we'll delve into the legacy of slavery on American taxation. You're listening to Berlin Journal from the American Academy in Berlin and NPR Berlin.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, host of NPR's On Point. You know, to be honest, these days it can feel like a lot just to hang on in the rush of news. To have a good, rich conversation in that rush, well, that's what we're all about. I hope you'll join us for the next On Point.
Welcome back to Berlin Journal. I'm RJ McGill. Here's my colleague Ashley Bamford to introduce historian Robin Einhorn.
As the campaign season slowly unfurls into 2016, taxes remain a key concern. And as Southerners, Midwesterners, East and West Coasters alike weigh their options before heading to the primaries in February or to the polls again in November, regional differences in political persuasion and class interests continue to dominate debates about taxation on both the left and the right. There's no easy solution. For Robin Einhorn, a Siemens Fellow at the American Academy last semester, American geography is the ideal lens through which to explore the complex relationship between Americans and taxes. More precisely, she focuses on the 19th century adoption of the federal income tax. Einhorn sat down with historian Sebastian Jobs of the JFK Institute to discuss her work on the legacy of slavery on American taxation. Jobs is the author of Welcome Home, Boys, Military Victory Parades in New York City.
Lobbyists have rigged the tax code.
We keep increasing the per-child tax credit for working families.
Their effective tax rates, as Warren Buffett offered.
Where the average American can fill out our taxes on a postcard.
So, Robin, tell me, what is your current project you work on the American Academy about?
So I've been writing a history of tax politics in the United States, a long history, seeing the story whole rather than just starting with the income tax in the 20th century. So building on my previous work of kind of the 18th century story and just trying to think about how earlier history influenced later.
In one of our conversations we had before this interview, you mentioned how the political discourse between the North and the South influenced the introduction of the income tax. What can you tell me about this?
Well, what's kind of surprising if you think about American politics today, it's that the real champions of the income tax from the 1890s, even earlier, through the adoption of the 16th Amendment, and then through most of the 20th century, were Southerners. It was a Southern project in particular, Southern Democrats. And they wanted it for obvious reasons. The obvious reason was that it was supposed to be a tax only on the very rich, and it was a tax on only the very rich until the Second World War, and hardly any of those people lived in the South. So the idea was that Southerners would get relief from tariffs, which subsidized the North at their expense, with an income tax that would subsidize them at Northern expense and really reverse the whole direction of federal taxation.
So what is the time frame we talk about? When was the 16th Amendment added to the Constitution?
So it finally in 1913. So what happened was a small income tax was attached to a tariff in 1894, and in 1895 the Supreme Court declares it unconstitutional. With a kind of fabulous sense of irony, by using a clause in the Constitution that had originally been adopted to protect Southern slaveholders against Northerners. And it's very complicated, but it said that direct taxes have to be apportioned by population rather than by wealth or income. So the Supreme Court said an income tax is unconstitutional, and that's why it required a constitutional amendment. The next big tariff fight was in 1909, and it was again complicated. Republicans wanted to keep high tariffs, and a price they had to pay was to send an income tax amendment to the states, which they thought wasn't a high price because they couldn't imagine it would be ratified. Well, the Southern states ratify immediately, but to get to 3/4 of the state legislatures, which is what you need for a constitutional amendment, something had to happen in the North. And the thing that happened in the North was progressivism, was the split in the Republican Party that allowed a Democratic surge that brought about ratifications in the North as well.
Given the context of the Civil War, of Reconstruction, the end of the 19th century that brought this discussion about, would you say that the introduction of the income tax was kind of a weapon of an underdog that was introduced to political discourse because the South felt, Southern states felt overwhelmed by Northern economic power? Or how would you interpret this?
If you look at the long history, I think what you see is that Southerners have shaped policy throughout American history, except right after the Civil War, because, you know, losing a Civil War can be costly. But what happened was, they couldn't abide, in the Revolutionary era, they couldn't abide wealth taxation because that would involve taxing slaves. So the only tax they could adopt was the tariff on imported goods. Then they decided they didn't like that. But they got it way down just before the Civil War. Then after the Civil War, it shot up. And they wanted the income tax. And they liked that for decades. Southerners were the heads of the Ways and Means Committee throughout the post-World War II period, Wilbur Mills most famously by the 1970s. And by then, the South is getting richer, and Southerners are suddenly paying as much income tax as everyone else. And that's when you get the tax revolt that really transformed American tax politics again. So Southerners are actually very powerful in all of these periods. And one reason for that is that in American history, what you have much of the time is two-party politics in the North and one-party politics in the South. And that makes the South very powerful.
Your former project was also about taxation and the topic of slavery. How does that relate to your current project? Or what was your first book, or your second book, namely, about your book about slavery and taxation?
Taxation was a good lens for understanding the impact of slavery on American politics, American government. And taxes are affected by slavery because everything was affected by slavery. Rather than, say, looking at fugitive slave laws or the spread of slavery westward into the territories or the things that you already know are about slavery, by looking at taxes, which are not kind of automatically about slavery, you can really see the influence. And that's what my American Taxation, American Slavery was about.
You're listening to historian Monica Green speaking with Michael Gordon on NPR Berlin.
Americans, we don't mind paying our fair share of taxes.
Major taxes. And I think we ought to abolish the IRS.
The wealthiest people in this country.
We are lowering taxes on small business. You know, a lot of business activity.
One of the arguments you make is that today in American politics, you have the argument of a strong government being a danger to democracy, to individual liberty and freedom. And you kind of push back towards this, to this argument. How does your understanding and your research and source of you've consulted and your interpretation and your research, how does it inform this kind of debate? Because nowadays we have strong government equals is a bad decision because it restrains political freedom. What can you talk? How can you talk to this for a moment?
First of all, I wouldn't exaggerate the degree to which Americans oppose the things that government does. If you look at polling data, even about taxes, if you ask someone, would you rather pay less, they will, of course, say, yes, I would rather pay less. If you ask them, but would you rather pay less or have good infrastructure, good schools, you know, the other good things that taxes buy, war is a whole other issue. But if you ask them if they'd like government services, then their views of taxes become much less hostile. So we have, of course, a political party in the United States since the 1970s dedicated to making this anti-government argument. And it's complex why they do. But to hear this rhetoric is not to say that Americans in general are anti-government, because it's not true. Now, to say that there was a political argument in my historical research, I think I would take exception to that. I looked at the tax systems that were in existence, and I looked at the debates about them, mostly in the 18th and first half of the 19th century, in the age of slavery, and I concluded that the taxes looked different, that they were more sophisticated than the North, and I concluded that fears of democratic politics leading to confiscatory taxes that would lead to the abolition of slavery powered enormous amounts of political decisions, both at the state level and in the United States Constitution itself. This was an anti-government, a threat that government, of course, what the slaveholders said was that government was a threat to liberty. But what they meant by liberty is what we mean by slavery.
It strikes me how talking about taxes seems to be a common thread in American politics. You talk about the revolution, the time of the revolution. We talk about the tariff or the tariff system in the 19th century. In your current project, you talk about the introduction of the income tax in the early 20th century. And it goes on and on and on until today. So I wonder, in current American politics, talking about taxes is pretty much toxic. It is the third rail of politics. You cannot really talk about it, or you cannot talk about at least about raising taxes. And there is the Grover Norquist pledge almost all congressional Republicans have to take, that they won't raise taxes when they are in office. So raising taxes is an absolute political no-go, at least for Republicans. What can we learn from your research about this current political debate or the status or the state of talking about taxes in American politics? Do you see a continuity there as well, or are there big breaks and shifts?
Well, there are big breaks and shifts, of course. The era from the Second World War until the 1970s was a period when you just didn't have this kind of anti-tax politics really at all. And the continuities that I see are just changes in the political economy, in this case, the rise of the Sun Belt. Changes in the political economy lead to changing political priorities that people start duking it out, and they invoke as if the Boston Tea Party had nothing to do with taxes at all. It was about a monopoly grant to the East India Company. But anyway, as if the United States has this kind of anti-tax DNA, which is completely not true. It is true that Republicans right now emphasize, well, until right now when they have new issues, but have emphasized this anti-tax. But just as what winning political groups do is assert that the things they believe are the things everybody believes. In fact, even if they lose, they assert that the things they believe are the things everybody believes. And you just can't take claims like that at face value. And my research shows that for all of American history. And I think that it's probably too true for other places, but that's not what I write about.
So last question. You, just when I mentioned that I found that you make a political argument, you took exception to that. Point taken. But would you say that your research and you as a researcher, as a historian, are politically active in what you're doing?
If the question is, are there political implications of my findings? Certainly, yes. But they are my findings from doing research, not into what Americans believe. And this is what makes my work really different from what a lot of other people do. Because I don't read the political rhetoric and say this is what Americans believed. I read the laws, and I read the debates about forming institutions and changing institutions, about what should be in a tariff law, which was basically the answer was everything anyone could put in it. And when I look at these practical debates about how to do these practical things, I find that these broad ideological arguments are simply not the important story, the important history. It's politics.
Thanks, Robin, for joining us on the Berlin Journal.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure, Sebastian.
You've been listening to an interview with Robin Einhorn, a professor of U.S. history at the University of California at Berkeley, speaking with Sebastian Jobs of the Free University of Berlin. After the break, we'll hear a bit of fiction from writer Anthony Mara's critically acclaimed new book of short stories, The Czar of Love and Techno. We're back with Berlin Journal. I'm your host, R.J. McGill. On a recent rainy evening in November in Kreuzberg, an audience gathered at the English Theater to hear an interview and reading with Anthony Mara, the acclaimed author of A Constellation of Vital Phenomena and the fiction fellow at the Academy last fall.
And thank you all for coming out this evening.
I had the privilege of interviewing Mara about his work, and he treated the audience to a few passages from his newest book, The Czar of Love and Techno, which had just been published by Crown in the U.S. So I'm going to read a little bit. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about Anthony or Tony. Should we do Tony tonight?
We're among friends.
All right. We're going to do Tony tonight.
As with his novel, the collection concerns the bloody history of Russia and the Caucasus since the end of the Second World War.
It also vividly underscores the disorienting effects of Soviet communism and offers an intertwined story that snakes from the paranoid life of a Soviet censor to the ripples of secrecy two generations later. It is at turns grim, touching, and hilarious. Here's Anthony Mara reading from The Czar of Love and Techno.
My mother, as I've said, wanted no more from life than an afternoon at the Black Sea. That August, my father came home with leopard print bikinis. What are we supposed to do with these? Kolya asked, eyeing the two-piece. It's a swimsuit, my father said. I'll give you one guess. It's a bikini, Kolya protested. My father grabbed the top piece from Kolya's hands and tossed it in the trash. Now it's what the Americans call a Speedo. This summer, Lake Mercury. Next summer, the Black Sea, my father promised. But contrary to his plans, by the next summer, the pain in my mother's chest would have already taken her to the doctor, then the hospital, then the crematorium, and finally, the living room bookshelf, where her ashes still rest and will likely spend eternity in a pickle jar between a can of spare buttons and two phone books, despite my father's promises to one day scatter them in the Black Sea. But before all that, We went as a family to Lake Mercury. My mother in her leopard print bikini, my brother and I in our leopard print bikini bottoms, and we splashed in the lake, the water a mouthful of dirty change, my open eyes burning as I watched the flailing limbs of decapitated swimmers. And at the end of the day, when everyone was sun drunk or punch drunk or just drunk, that hour in summer when falling inhibition and rising permissibility intersect, my father chased my mother across the gravel bank. With leaping strides, he lunged for her in her leopard print bikini, claiming he was a leopard opterist, that he would pin and mount her. And my brother and I chased them, two cubs protecting our leopardess. We bared our teeth and snarled, clawed, growled, and all the while my father chased and my mother fled. Never had I seen her so happy, never so loved, so wanted. Never had I seen her as a sexual being, as desired quarry, as anything but a taciturn and dissatisfied figure at the kitchen sink who occasionally walloped me over the head with a soup ladle. And even though my father had no appreciation for metaphor or feline biology or the sunbathers he hurtled over, even though he was my father and she my mother, and we were all just a few steps from the precipice, I look back at that moment, that afternoon, with flooded longing, and think we should all be so lucky to get from this life a sunny day swim in chemical waste.
That was writer Anthony Morrow, the fiction fellow at the Academy last fall. He was reading from his latest collection of short stories, The Czar of Love and Techno, published by Crown in October. And that's it for this edition of Berlin Journal, a production of the American Academy in Berlin, NPR Berlin, and NPR Worldwide. For more on the American Academy in Berlin, please visit our website, americanacademy.de. And for more on NPR Berlin, please visit our website, nprberlin.de. Our production team includes Monica Mueller-Kroll in Berlin and Kingsley Smith in Washington. We would also like to thank our sound engineers Nelson Schultz and Daniel Schmielken, and offer a special thanks to Anna Wolofsky of Alex Offener Kanal Berlin for use of their studio space. From the American Academy in Berlin, I'm your host, RJ McGill.
And I'm co-host Ashley Bamford. Thanks for joining us on Berlin Journal.